I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. By wide acclaim, Maryland has a housing shortage problem. The state is losing middle-income population due to the lack of housing they can afford. A State of the Economy report from early 2024 from the Office of Maryland's Comptroller identified housing costs as a key reason for the state's slow economic growth, on which depend many things, including education and transportation spending. 2024 was the year of housing in the state legislature. The Moore administration, with the state housing secretary Jake Day at the center, pushed through three housing bills, one to get affordability, another to allow more financing for housing, and a third for tenants' rights. But on the crucial issue of opening up zoning to more density, the General Assembly elided the issue. Given budget realities and the upcoming 2026 gubernatorial election season, it is likely that the 2025 session will tackle small r regulatory matters rather than shape-shifting housing policy. Recently, two big housing activists in the state, Tom Cole, lawyer, radio host, and housing lobbyist, and Salim Firth, a senior research fellow and director of the Urbanity Project at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, got together to write a paper on how Maryland and its counties could reform the permitting process. Not just paperwork reduction, but more strategically to achieve the goal of increasing housing supply. Both Tom Cole and Salim Firth joined I Hate Politics for a deep dive into their ideas. A link to their paper is included in the show notes. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloot on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutro and Juniper.
Can't make decisions anyway. Don't wanna choose what I'm gonna eat. Nobody I wanna be. I walk down the middle of my street, 'cause I'm neutral. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Salim Firth, Tom Cole, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
The two of you wrote a policy brief recently asking Maryland to simplify its building permitting system. And you categorized the recommendations in three buckets. Tom, you want to talk about what those three buckets are?
When Salim and I got started on this, I think a lot of the conversations we were having about permitting, people were very sort of in the weeds on it and talking more about signatures and forms and things like that. What Salim had said was find those things that are peculiar to Maryland, or at least that we have solutions unique to Maryland. And so that's how we came up with the three buckets of public participation, process improvements, and then tracking housing production and targeting growth.
Salim, from the Mercatus point of view, because you said, you know, pick things that are relevant to Maryland, what is the overall permitting lay of the land? I'd imagine a lot of these are applicable pretty much, you know, in Virginia or in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's more different than I thought when I started this project, looking at a lot of different states. And some of that is state laws and longstanding constitutional doctrines. So for instance, Virginia has a big problem in that their tradition does not allow for impact fees. So if you build a building in Virginia, the county can't say, hey, you have to chip in some money for schools and roads and sewers. In Maryland, we can do that just fine. And the concern is that sometimes those fees are too large. But those kinds of differences just create really different incentive structures for the different actors. And there are really different laws and judicial traditions across the states that mean it's the big principles, right, of how do you, you know, you want to create, say, balanced fiscal incentives so that, you know, development isn't a fiscal killer for a locality. You want to make sure that the laws treat people reasonably fairly and that there's, you know, redress if something is going to hurt somebody, but it's not easy to bring frivolous lawsuits. But ultimately, the structures that allow that are really, really different across the states. And I'm just impressed, sometimes overwhelmed, with how much detail I have to learn to be able to say something actionable.
So specifically with respect to impact taxes, Maryland allows impact taxes. Virginia has proffers.
That's right.
And so what is the actionable item from here?
So for Maryland, we didn't have anything about impact fees because, you know, there's a balance and, you know, it's not always perfect. We're not saying it's great, but this is not a kind of a red flag area where the state needs to really change the structure. I wrote one of these for Virginia, and there we said, you've got to try to work towards allowing impact fees because in Virginia, you can't zone as a county. You can't zone by right, or you lose the chance to get your proffers. Proffers only go along with a rezoning. And so the theory of planning is that, you know, the county or city is going to think about the broad public good, make sure that factories don't end up next to preschools, and, you know, reasonably organize and separate uses on a rational basis. This is fiction virtually everywhere in the country. But even in the best planned counties in Virginia, they don't zone for what they want because they would lose their proffers. And at least in Maryland, we can say, hey, we want multifamily housing here. We're going to zone for multifamily housing here. And when you build it, you'll chip in a fee to defray the costs. And that's a reasonable system. So that's something Maryland gets right. And it's great. I'm able to take that to other states.
The flexibility of proffers and the certainty of impact taxes, how do you weigh those two things?
You know, I think of Carol Rose, the great law professor, wrote an article back in the 80s, planning versus dealing, right? So I gave that sort of the theory of zoning is that it's this rational, you know, organization of the city or county. Rose says, we know this isn't really how it's done, but that's okay. Dealing is okay. I think proffers fall short of the ideal of dealing because they block these sort of upfront city-led rezonings. And that means that even your simplest, most desirable projects are forced to go through this rezoning system. And you have this weird fiscal setup. Now, I suppose it's worse in, say, Massachusetts, where you just can't get these fees at all. There's no proffer and there's no impact fee beyond like on-site water and sewer. And so like nobody wants growth. Growth costs money. Getting these fiscal institutions right is really, really valuable.
Okay. What does Maryland do wrong that Virginia does right?
You know, I'm not that familiar with Virginia. And so I wouldn't really be able to speak to the contrast other than the fact that I know that a number of my clients that I work with are moving their focus to Virginia, that the ability to get housing out of the ground in a shorter period of time is much more accessible in Virginia than it might be in Maryland. I know that one of the biggest caps on growth, or I guess weights on growth around here, are our adequate public facilities ordinances, where in some jurisdictions they've seen the light and realized that you're not going to be able to stop in migration by closing development. And then we have others that have gone in the opposite direction and taken more aggressive means to stop housing growth through their adequate facilities ordinance. I would also say that the environmental regulations that we have in the state of Maryland are onerous, particularly as it relates to forest conservation, stormwater management. Those regulations end up weighing down the not just the cost of housing, because as you and Salim were talking about impact fees and proffers, I do think that there is an important distinction, and not always a difference, but an important distinction in that there are things that just make housing more expensive, and then there are things that just stop units from being built. And APFO, forest conservation, stormwater management, those are things that physically take up large portions of a given parcel and make it, in some circumstances, undevelopable, at least in a from a feasibility circumstance.
Does Virginia or any other state get the forest conservation and stormwater management right?
It's hard to know when people get things right because they don't complain about them. No one says, you know, we have the perfect balance here. There's an equal amount of frustration on the developer side and the official side, because right, developers getting everything they want isn't necessarily the right balance. You know, I think places that say, here's the rule, we know what it is, it's meetable. And this is where I think Maryland gets off track, is we have rules that are written for the case where the development is in the most environmentally sensitive area. And we apply that statewide, right? So we say, here's your forest conservation rule. And by the way, this is the same whether you're, you know, developing a wetland beside the Patuxent or a parking lot next to the metro, right? And those are really different contexts. And development is going to make that parking lot better, right? Like almost anything that's going to get built is going to make stormwater runoff in that location better. And you're going to add a few trees. And the Patuxent is a different story, but we have these sort of same regulations, and then you have to go through a waiver process because the county knows. Planners aren't dumb. They know. They want that redevelopment. It's all in all their plans. They're calling for growth by the metro stations. But they have to go through this, what they call alternative compliance, which is a fancy way for saying not complying, because we know that complying is actually completely unrealistic. And so we're going to waive these regulations for you, but only after we negotiate the conditions of the waiver for a year or two.
So the year or two is the problem, really. I mean, more than anything else. You don't mind the negotiation, is just the year or two. So specifically, Tom, with respect to stormwater management, to this issue, how does your recommendation solve this problem of having a stormwater management regime that just is universal and, you know, has the Patuxent River Basin and the parking lot in the same under the same rules?
What happens is in some circumstances, you can have three different sets of environmental standards, of waiver standards for the same environmental consideration. Stormwater being one of them, and for forest conservation, it's two different standards, and that's federal, state, and local. And there really wasn't a good way, we didn't think, to recommend making those universal, to sort of take away the power of the localities to state their preferences, to supersede the state's legislative prerogative in terms of where it was. So we said, rather than making those universal, to make either them a ceiling or a floor, let's say if someone is going to apply for a waiver from those regulations, that should be a uniform process. There shouldn't be different standards for waivers for the same condition. So, and how this works is that the local Department of Planning is often the one that is applying the federal, state, and local mandates, those regulations. So one waiver can be applied to them with the same standard for all of those. And it can be considered in terms of unnecessary hardship, uniqueness of the parcel. For those that are involved in land use and development, those are terms that would be familiar to them. So that was number one. The second one was, and this was one that we got from our very good friend and a great advocate in this space, Casey Anderson, which was to include conserved land in density calculations. So what you'll see in many jurisdictions, the net acreage is all that you can develop, not the gross acreage, but the net acreage. And net acreage often will be the gross acreage minus floodplains and steep slopes, or minus wetlands and steep slopes. And what Casey pointed out, and I think is a great point, you know, well, if you can build up, or you can just build denser and not infringe upon those protected areas, why are we taking that out of the net acreage? Why are we creating this differential? And so while, and what that does, it still serves the environmental intent. It still preserves those protected areas of steep slopes, wetlands, floodplains, whatever they may be. Those are still being protected, but we're still meeting our housing needs by allowing a greater density to build, to be able to be built in the development envelope.
And it's not just about the density, right? So you get that. So, you know, say you're able to count the density from the half of your site that's wetlands and steep slopes. You get to move that density to the buildable portion. Great. You're able to have more housing. Not only that, you're cutting down on the stakes in the negotiation, right? Because if I, as a developer, am going back and forth with like, how steep is this grade really? And I'm going to send out my surveyors and they come up with a different number than the county surveyors. I'm not going to fight so hard if I get the same number of units in the end, right? I'd like flexibility on my buildable site, and maybe, you know, in an extreme case, I won't be able to use all the units. But in general, that's going to cut way, way down on the stakes. And some counties, like Montgomery County, where I live, does this the right way, the gross density. But some other counties don't do it this way, and it would be better for everyone if we had less of a fight between conservation and housing, and more of a like, well, let's have as much of both of these good things as we can get.
Some of this doesn't resolve the overlap. You have sought to create a universal waiver system in response to the variability of the forest conservation, stormwater regimes, when the original problem, remember, as Salim described it, was that you could not have a universal set of rules for parking lots and a river basin.
We did not want to get into a circumstance where we were proposing things that were just not meeting the political climate of Maryland. This is something that, without opening up whether or not policymakers want to protect forest or want to have stormwater considerations, it's rather saying we understand that these are policy priorities. So is housing. How can we have these things all exist in the same place?
One thing that I was surprised about in this was that floodplain seems like something that modern topographical GIS should be able to handle. But in site-specific contexts, the people that we spoke to, the professionals, said it doesn't really work that way. The slopes, you know, the difference of where water runs off is so fine within a, you know, the kind of the granularity of the site that you're looking at. They viewed a kind of a statewide mapping exercise as a negative, because that would give them sort of regulated land that actually they should build on, and unregulated land that they didn't want to build on because it would get soaked. And functionally, the developer and the county have to send surveyors out to the site, see where the, like, you know, little rivulets that flow down a grassy slope during a rainstorm, like, where are those on this particular piece of land? And it's just too granular for mapping, and sort of like rational, like, okay, we know where the water is. Obviously you do that with big bodies of water, but we're being very, very careful about this in Maryland. And the result is that you have to go look at the site.
The developers do not want a statewide survey. They'd rather do this side by side, right? And that requires a certain kind of expertise at the planning level to be able to hold those negotiations. And the question there is time. The first set of proposals have to do with public participation. So in that process is where public participation becomes such a big deal.
Every decision point is an opportunity for appeal and delay. One of the more controversial parts of our paper obviously relates to public participation. There is, you know, almost seen as carved into our very constitution as citizens is the right to have our say over whatever our neighbor does. But what we see from the data is that the people that actually participate are normally the same. They're normally people that are comfortably housed. They're normally doing well socioeconomically. They commonly don't have kids, and they're not the people that are needing housing the most or the ones that will benefit the most from development. So Salim and I recommended a re-examination of this, a re-examination as far as whether or not there should be public hearings on by right development, which I think just only serves to frustrate the public and make them more cynical about land development policies. But then I would say more ambitiously re-examine who can appeal these decisions. We have people that just make literally a hobby out of appealing and stopping development. And they do not have a economic interest in that development one way or the other, nor is there any risk to them to appeal this to the furthest extent available, whereas the developer is losing money on carrying costs every day that that project is not built.
In Connecticut, my colleague did research and found that the lots of people sue over inland wetlands decisions. So this is a case where they're not suing the developer. They're suing the commission, which is a body that works for the town. And the town says, yep, you know, this development is okay. It's not harming our local wetlands. Well, Connecticut makes it so anybody in the state can sue. And they do, all of them. 80% of those lawsuits are thrown out. And yet, on average, they take up a year. If I come and I say, hey, I'm going to build affordable housing in your town, somebody might come and say, I will sue you if you try to build that affordable housing. But if you make it high-income housing, then, you know, we can come to an agreement.
The legal standard for administrative appeals, you have said in the paper, has been relaxed in Maryland over time. How so?
Yeah, the statutory language, as I understand, hasn't changed. But in a series of cases, judges have found, oh, yeah, this person can appeal. This person can appeal.
Yes. Originally, the way and the concept is specially aggrieved was that you needed to have some injury separate and apart from the public at large in order to appeal it. So that would be essentially diminishment of property values. That's how this sentiment started in our case law. But over time, it's broadened to include up to a quarter mile away from the property, depending on what you can identify is in relation to your interest for that property.
The standard for any kind of tort is aggrievement. What happened to bring about that change?
I think that a biggest thing was the broadening of rights and considerations that a appellant can raise. Going down to, you know, endangered insects.
But why only Maryland?
This was not a comparative law study. We did not spend time saying this is how Maryland is unique. It's rather analyzing the development environment in the state and saying these are the things that are gumming things up. So I will also say that other jurisdictions have addressed standing. They've done it legislatively where they have required appellants to post bonds to as it relates to a project if they're going to appeal. They've required appellants to pay attorney's fees for appeals if they are unsuccessful. So you're right that Maryland is not unique in having a administrative appeal process subject to abuse. But Maryland is different from those states that have taken action.
Salim, do you know of states that have done that?
There's a number of different approaches. So Wisconsin did something close to what we're suggesting, just rigorously narrowing the standing to appeal. New Hampshire, in a somewhat different context, they created a housing appeals board, which the goal of which is to resolve disputes mostly between developers and towns, because they've really, unlike us, they have really small towns. So they have this problem of citizen government where you have non-lawyers making law decisions. And, you know, non-lawyers like me make lots of mistakes when we start to play around with the law. And so you get towns that do things that are illegal all the time. And if you're a developer or if you're just a property owner trying to, you know, build an addition or, you know, change your paint color or something and the town tells you you can't, you could go to court, but that's going to be expensive and take, you know, a year, even if you know you're right. The Housing Appeals Board gets you a quick answer, very low cost. If the side that loses at the appeals board wants, they can appeal. But by this time, they've heard from some of, you know, the best land use lawyers in the state who sit on the board. And they kind of know, okay, this was not a hard case, you know, chapter and verse, the town broke the law and has to give this guy his permit. So that's, you know, that's a very context specific solution that works really well for them. In Rhode Island, they had a housing appeals board from some other decade that was working so poorly that the reform was to get rid of it and get stuff back into the courts because the housing appeals board in Rhode Island was not working.
One of your recommendations is to have third party review of plans. Are your friends in the planning department okay with this kind of thing?
It was said many times by our friends, that by the folks that we were interviewing in those planning departments, of saying, if you want things to go faster, we need more resources. In jurisdictions that had third-party review, they were able to have a more expedient process. And we also heard from some of those that we interviewed in those planning departments that they got better products in the door when there was some facet of third-party review, because there's different levels of third-party review. You can have third-party review where they say this is final and approvable, and then it goes to the planning department for a ministerial sign-off. And then you have another version of third-party review where they review it and they say, we're used to this planning department. These are the comments that they're going to make. Make those changes. And then once you actually do put it into the planning department, it's a faster process. It's still the same process, but it's faster than it would be otherwise.
We heard some degree of complaint from both sides about unsophisticated counterparties, right? So when you're doing a high rise, pretty complicated project, the person in the planning department reviewing it is a generalist and might miss things on the first pass that are ultimately going to have to be addressed. And sending it to a specialist first gets you closer to the finished product. And a lot of planning departments recognize this, especially if they're in smaller jurisdictions. They want complicated projects to go out. And the flip side is from the county planner's point of view, they'll get really incomplete applications from a developer who doesn't know that jurisdiction, right? So smaller, less sophisticated, or working for the first time in a new jurisdiction that does things differently. Those end up using a lot of time.
What I found really attractive among your recommendations was actually pre-approved standardized plans. You expand by right, and you have a bunch of pre-approved standardized plans, some of these problems just go away.
That also empowers localities. I think that local government doesn't understand that if it gets out of the obstructionist mindset and puts itself more into the facilitation mindset, it's actually going to have much more impact on the development that it has in its community. It's taking a proactive approach of recognizing the development's going to come. And that if you're obstructing it and trying to hold it back, it's going to go over and around you and it's going to be haphazard. However, if you facilitate development and you actually say, no, I'm going to make this happen, I'm going to play an active role in making it happen, you can have more of an impact on what actually comes out the other side. So pre-approved housing plans is a good example of that.
Talk a little bit about the early and late vesting. And here, actually, you do compare between Maryland and Virginia. What does vesting mean with respect to entitlements? How long should they continue to have them? What if they're just sitting on their preliminary proposal?
The issue with all of the regulatory scheme is that if it's predictable and anticipated, it can be managed. If it's unpredictable or unanticipated, it can't be managed. And so right now, Maryland is a late vesting state, which essentially means for all intents and purposes, you do not have the entitlements until the shovel lifts dirt out of the ground, until it is observable to the general public that development is happening on that parcel. What we're recommending is that we move that earlier in the process. And when there is a significant investment made in response to a government decision, that the entitlements will vest at that point in time.
It's interesting you say that, because impact taxes versus proffers, one is certain and one is not. The problem I have seen in Montgomery County, I mean, $100,000 is no money in Montgomery County development context. Now, if I was building something in Allegheny, but in Montgomery County, you know, people have spent some money and they sit on the project waiting for the market to, you know, build, and only then will they go forward. How do you incentivize them if you're going to, you know, do early vesting?
We've got a housing crisis and housing prices are going off every minute. And also, you know, land costs are not cheap. There are other things that we can do to incentivize people to put their land to the highest and best use. If we want to do a land value tax, you know, I'm fine with going forward with that as well. I think that's a different one of Salim's papers. Ultimately, I would say that I don't think Maryland has a big problem, nor will it have a big problem with people buying land, getting entitlements, and sitting on it.
Vesting statutes never give a permanent right. There's always some kind of clock. Like if you don't take any action at all, then after some number of years, that's an easy clause to put in a statute, and they should. We've certainly seen nationally a lot of builders, you know, freezing with these interest rates. So they don't want to take out the loans they would need to start projects right now. And, you know, business cycles come and go. Let's not make law based on the business cycle we're in. By the time we make the law, the business cycle will change. People are going to hold land. And like Tom said, if you really want to disincentivize that, you can pass a land value tax. I think that has, my view is that has some pretty big downsides that people should think about, but, you know, worth kicking the tires. The vesting is just not, I think, a big component of what makes people say, I'm not going to build right now. And much more importantly, when they do want to build, but it takes time, right? So we're imposing these time costs in environmental negotiations and the on the affordable housing, the time it takes to organize financing. Those are policy decisions. And the least we can do as a polity is say, hey, while you're going through these arduous processes of abiding by the rules that we want you to follow, we're not going to change the rules on you. Tom, you had a great example that we talked about of a project in Ellicott City.
This is a project that was hung up by every type of regulation and had to apply for waivers, had to appeal those waivers. And every time they would get to the finish line, the law would change again. And they would have to start that process over again. And this is a project that was originally submitted for development in 2018 and likely will not get a final green light until 2025. And during all of this time, they've had this land under contract. They've been paying deposits to the owner. They've been paying carrying costs. They've been paying for engineering drawings that had to be scrapped and thrown away for new engineering drawings to be drafted. And like, that's no way to live. Like, I know we sort of think of developers as these endless fonts of money and, you know, they can afford to do it, but that's simply not true. A developer is normally one project away from going bankrupt. We can note that by our president-elect, I suppose. But, you know, it isn't a good way to manage our development climate to say that the trapdoor can be pulled on you at any minute. And also, more importantly, can be weaponized against an individualized project.
I think the biggest problem is that developers are not building. It's the interest environment. It's a bunch of other things. So how do we incentivize really developers to start and finish projects using this mechanism of housing targets?
Before we get to targets, the thing we have to have is good data. And Maryland has taken a step towards that with House Bill 131 last session. And I just think that's really important. We have had poor data. Montgomery County was embarrassed when their internal data was different than what they were reporting to the census last year, 2 years ago. So getting high quality data is a precondition, because otherwise, you know, we're sort of feeling in a dark room.
If you were to talk to any anti-housing, anti-growth council member about why we need to build more housing, they're going to turn around and they're going to say, well, you know what? This developer owns this lot over there and they're not developing it. I don't have any control over them developing it. When you get them off their duff developing, then you can talk to me about how we need to build more housing. I've also heard local governments and local government advocacy organizations say, we don't build housing. We don't have any control over how much housing is being built. which is nonsense. Not only do you need to let more housing go through, you need to start incentivizing development. You need to do what now Secretary Day, former Mayor Jake Day, did in Salisbury and say, we don't have enough housing. We're going to incentivize it. We're going to have a period of time where if you get your permit in by this amount of time, all your fees are waived. That is how bad our housing crisis is right now in the state of Maryland. It is not enough to say yes in my backyard. We need to say yes, please. We need to be soliciting development. And those targets are a way that we can say, all right, we're this far behind. This is where we need to go.
Tom Gull, Salim Fuad, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Sunil. Thank you so much.
What lessons can we draw from my conversation with Salim Fuad, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and Maryland lawyer, housing lobbyist, and radio host Tom Cole? First, I've included a link to the paper by Firth and Cole in the show notes. Download it, read it, talk it back to me. Sending us a voice letter is easy. Record on your phone and email the file to producer@ihppod.org. Second, Maryland's housing problem needs some parsing. The state is losing population, but it needs to build more housing. How come? Maryland isn't the only state in this situation. California, Massachusetts, others have the same problem. Housing advocates explain this by putting the horse before the cart, the horse being the housing shortage and the cart being depopulation. What is harder to explain, however, is that the population loss is most acute in the middle income brackets. But housing policy focus, both at the state and in the counties, is on deep affordability for poorer families. There is little doubt that housing shortage affects the poor most of all. Spending the bulk of your income on housing while sharing a single family home, sometimes overcrowding it, can be dangerous and does not build family wealth. This raises the issue of what is affordability, and that's a whole another can of worms itself. Affordability is, first of all, a locational problem based on demand. Bethesda housing is expensive in part because a lot of people want to live there because of its proximity to jobs, good schools, transportation networks, and entertainment. In contrast, Cumberland, Maryland is affordable for housing, but jobs are scarce. There is no transit that connects to jobs. The schools suffer from underinvestment, and entertainment opportunities are limited. But affordability is also a function of income. Higher the income, greater the affordability. When there is talk of affordability, however, the focus is on the poor. But absent large government subsidies, low-income people are generally not going to be able to live in Bethesda or, in the last decade, in Tacoma Park, where once housing was indeed deeply affordable. Third, in trying to understand and remedy why Maryland or Montgomery County or another similar jurisdiction has a housing shortage problem, we have to look comparatively. What is Maryland doing wrong that other states are doing right? And so therefore, getting more housing. Maryland's favorite point of comparison is the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is a bigger state, but has a somewhat lower household income than Maryland. Is growing faster economically in population and adding more housing. The lower household income is somewhat misleading to the comparison because Northern Virginia, which is the part of the Commonwealth most alike to Maryland, is actually wealthier. Fairfax, Loudoun, and Arlington counties all have higher household income than Maryland's richest county, Montgomery. But if you want to find out what Virginia does differently, the answers are actually unclear. Virginia has a proffer system where developers make offers to local jurisdictions to do something in return to get their preferred zoning. It is negotiated and therefore unpredictable. Yet developers say they prefer that to Montgomery County's impact taxes, which are more predictable but can be quite hefty. So, In reality, predictability is not as desirable as, well, I'm not sure I have an answer, but neither do others. There is also talk of tax burdens, building incentives, and other factors, but in the end, any discussion around a comparison between Montgomery and Northern Virginia in particular comes down to business climate, which I can best describe as politics. Or better still, the I hate politics zeitgeist. If businesses hate the political environment in Montgomery, many liberals choose to live in Montgomery and take on the horrendous morning commute to Virginia because they hate the increasingly purple politics of Virginia. If there's anything uniquely Maryland or Montgomery, it is its sometimes obdurate politics. Lastly, I want to take a minute on the idea of land value tax, arguably the most sensible economic idea in the history of mankind, which did not really take. The modern version of the idea comes from the 19th century journalist and politician Henry George, who saw public value in land and wanted the public to capture that value as a tax on the land itself. The contemporary version of the argument is to tax land for its best use and thereby incentivize landowners to put their land to that best use. While there are jurisdictions which require a ground duty tax, it is usually small. Most property taxes include taxing the value of land and what is built on it. Taxing buildings disincentivizes people from building more because that increases their tax burden. Instead, if land alone was taxed but not building, landowners would seek to build in ways that maximize their income from the building. In other words, they would put in multifamily housing. Alas, sometimes economics remains a theoretical exercise. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band, Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time. She's watching TV. She's looking at me.